just as I said that, people come pouring through the door. Well, short people come pouring through the door. More kids to the army in there. All right, we're going to go to Daniel 5 tonight. Daniel 5, that's where we're starting. You need a little bit of background, you need a little bit of history in order to understand Daniel 5. At this point in the history of Babylon, Babylonia and its capital, the city of Babylon, at this point Nebuchadnezzar has died and his son Belshazzar is now the king of Babylon. And Belshazzar has witnessed his father's insanity that we talked about last week. Belshazzar knows all the things that Nebuchadnezzar went through, and he knows the declaration that Nebuchadnezzar made when he regained his sanity. And so he's responsible for all that. God holds him responsible for everything he knows, everything he's been through, everything he's witnessed. Babylon, when we talk about Babylon, you have to realize that this was a magnificent, large city that was completely encompassed by a wall. And in our modern lexicon, when we say wall, we kind of think 2x4s with some sheetrock on it. Get that picture out of your head. We're talking about something on the order of the Great Wall of China. In fact, the walls around Babylon were so wide, so thick, that you could ride a team of horses pulling a chariot behind them along the top of the wall to go from guard tower to guard tower around the circumference of the entire city. That's why Babylon became the place of choice for all the Middle Eastern kings to rule from, was that it was a completely defensible city. Once you closed the gates, there was no way to get into the city, and you could stand on the walls and stop any army that was coming toward you, because the only way in is over the wall. So there was just no way to get into the city. And as a result, once the king was in there and the gates were closed, they felt very safe. They felt very much like there was no way anybody could get to them. Now, Babylon sat right off the Tigris River. Now, there was an offshoot of the Tigris River that made it right to Babylon, the city. This was the other reason they were able to close the gates and close off the walls and stay there for years on end, was that they had fresh running water that ran right through the heart of the city, because they built the city around an offshoot of the Tigris River. And the water actually would go up to the wall. The way the wall was built, it was built over the river so that the water would hit the wall and then go under the wall and come up the other side. Now, at the very same time that Belshazzar took over in his father Nebuchadnezzar's place and was ruling Babylonia and ruling in Babylon, to the east in what is currently Iran, then called Persia, there was a king there, Cyrus, who Isaiah had predicted was going to rise up and take over Babylon and going to free the Israelites to go back and build the temple. I've talked about Cyrus before. Well, he was conquering all of that Persian area, and there were two warring tribal factions in that area at the time who were the Medes and the Persians. And Cyrus had successfully banded the Medes and Persians together by sort of co-ruling with Darius the Mede, who was the king of the Medes. And so he had put him in charge of his armies, and Darius was determined to take over Babylon. He was determined that if he could conquer Babylon, then they could sweep right through all the Middle East and that area of Eastern Europe and just rule the whole area. So what they had determined to do was they decided the only way to get into Babylon was to dam the river and keep the river dammed until the water level sank low enough they could go in via the river under the wall and come up on the other side, surprise everybody. So they decided, well, they were definitely going to do it at night. This seemed like a good plan. We'll do it at night, everybody be asleep. And they just wanted to get enough men into the city to open a gate. And then in floods the army, they take over Babylon. That was the plan. But it was going to take a little luck in order to pull this off, because they didn't know what they were going to find on the other side of the wall. So at the very beginning of chapter 5 of Daniel here, Darius and his armies happened to be amassed outside the wall of Babylon, damming up the river and planning to come in. And this is what's going on inside the city. And as soon as this chapter ends, in they sweep. And you're going to see that it was the hand of God. They were counting on some luck, and instead they found the providence of God waiting for them when they got there, because God was going to bring down one king and set up another, as we read last week. Daniel said, and Nebuchadnezzar came to the conclusion that the inhabitants of the earth and the armies of heaven are all reputed as nothing. God does whatever he wants among the inhabitants of the earth and the armies of heaven. None can stop his hand. None can say, what do you do? And based on that, Nebuchadnezzar said, I see now that God brings down one kingdom and sets up another. Well, God was about to do this again in this succession of kingdoms we've been looking at. So that brings us to Daniel 5. Okay? That was all introduction. What's the rule? Doesn't count against my time. Okay, good. As long as we know the rules. Chapter 5, verse 1 says, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. So this night, Belshazzar decides to throw the biggest party he can possibly throw, and he brings in everybody who's powerful. All his generals, all his lords, all the army, everybody gets them all in there and gets them drunk. While meanwhile, their enemies are amassing outside the wall. They're all inside having a party. Verse 2, Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded them to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple that was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes and their wives and their concubines could all drink out of those vessels. Big mistake, by the way. Large error made here. You know that the northern kingdom, the northern 12 tribes, were taken in the Assyrian captivity and taken off into Assyria, but the southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, the Levites that served in the temple, were taken in two waves into Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. And in the first wave, when they came in and conquered the high and mighty, they routed the temple because they knew that the temple was full of all this fabulous furniture, all this gold furniture. But all of that furniture and all of those vessels and cups and flatware, everything else that was in there to be used by the priests in the service of God, was all particularly consecrated to God, which is what the word holy means. It means set aside for God's particular use. It had all been consecrated with blood, it had all been consecrated with an oath, and it could only be used inside the temple by the priests for the service of the Lord. That's what God designated it for. So now this king rises up and says, I remember the treasure. The treasure that's in the treasure house that we took from the Jews. Let's have a drunken bacchanalia with all our whores and all our wives and all our captains and all our, and we'll drink out of the golden cups together. This will be a great time. Big mistake. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines all drank from them. God had to have been happy around then. Gee, this would be the stuff that I consecrated for my use, and now the concubines are drinking out of it? Verse 4, they drank wine, and they praised, using these cups, toasting with these cups that are dedicated to Yahweh, they praised their gods of gold and of silver and of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. The very gods that God himself said you were not to ever worship. When they went into Canaan, he said, these are merely rocks and stones. They don't breathe. They don't think. There is one God, the God that is in heaven. Now they're using the vessels that were consecrated to the God of heaven to worship statues and idols. Not a good idea. Verse 5, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Now, what you have to imagine here, and archaeology has now dug up over in that area of Babylon, these gigantic meeting halls, these massive halls, where they would have whitewashed walls, and every so many feet they would have large torches burning to light the hall. And behind where the king would have sat on a platform at the front of the hall, there was a series of torches behind him to light the white plaster wall behind him. And as everyone's sitting and toasting the king, and he's up there in all his splendor, on the white wall behind him, a hand shows up and starts writing on the wall. His reaction was, I love verse 6, then the king's countenance was changed. Yeah, I'm guessing. And his thoughts troubled him, I'll bet, so that the joints of his loins were loosed. Do I need to interpret that for you? He was scared spitless. Huh? He was so scared that his loins, his stomach, let go. And his knees struck one against the other. So he's standing there. He goes from being, I'm the king. Bring in my captains and my thousands. Bring in my concubines. Bring in my wives. Bring me the gold goblet that I can drink out of it and toast my gods. And then a hand shows up and starts writing on the wall. He goes to knock-kneed, losing his lunch, scared, spitless.
Sobered up
real quickly, yes indeed. Verse 7. And the king cried out loud to bring in the astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. Remember this band of idiots? You remember these guys? We've seen them the last couple chapters when King Nebuchadnezzar kept saying, bring me all my Chaldeans and my soothsayers and my magicians. I want them to tell me my dream. And if they don't tell me my dream, I'll cut them all into pieces and make their houses into dunghills. And of course, none of them could do it. So what does he do one more time? There's writing on the wall. I don't know what the writing on the wall means. Give me my Chaldeans and my magicians and my soothsayers. So the same gang of fools comes in and stares at it, and they're equally flummoxed by it. And the king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, whoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed in scarlet and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. People said, why third there? You have to remember that there was King Nebuchadnezzar, and then there was his son, and then there was another son that is Nabonidus. Nabonidus was probably the real ruler of the territory. Nabonidus was probably the real ruler. Belshazzar was either his brother or son, as they've tried to figure out the genealogy that happened there. But he was actually at his oasis, Nabonidus was at the time, had an oasis palace that he was currently at. Now, if any of this sounds familiar, if you go over to Babylon right now, how many palaces does Saddam Hussein have now?
20.
Something like 80 ridiculous palaces. He's spent something like $3-4 billion on the latest renovation of one of Nebuchadnezzar's old palaces. This was not uncommon for a king to have many palaces, especially if you're in a desert, to have an oasis palace. So Nebuchadnezzar's son, Nabonidus, was out of the city when this was all happening. But there's a little history for you. So the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed in scarlet and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing, and they could not make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Then the king Belshazzar was greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were all astonished. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say the father, made master of the magicians and astrologers and Chaldeans and soothsayers, forasmuch as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts, was found in this same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he'll show you the interpretation. Now, you know that Jeremiah said that it was going to be 70 years that Daniel and all of the Israelites were going to be in the Babylonish captivity. So that's why Daniel, by the time we looked at the 70 weeks, remember several weeks ago we looked at the 70 weeks of years? He was praying, I know the 70 years are about up, I've been reading Jeremiah, and I'm praying to you, God, that you will do what you said you were going to do. Well, since Nebuchadnezzar had passed away, Daniel and the memory of Daniel had kind of passed away, Belshazzar, Nabonidus had come into power, and now Daniel had become an old man there in Babylon that people had kind of forgotten about. So the queen jumps up and goes, wait, there's this old man. They say, go get him, bring him in, he'll tell you what this all means. Verse 13, then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, are you Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry? Verse 14, I have even heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. and I have heard of thee, that you can interpret, that you can make interpretations, and you can dissolve doubts. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, you shall be clothed in scarlet and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you'll be the third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be to yourself. Now, you have to know that when Daniel walked in and looked at what was written on the wall, he understood it. And he understood, when I tell you in a second what the interpretation is, he knew that the Medes were outside coming in through the river. He understood what was about to happen. This whole kingdom was about to be destroyed. So when the king says, hey, I'll make you third ruler. Oh, thanks. Yeah, because before daylight, you won't be ruler anymore. So, yeah. No, you can keep the gifts. Verse 17. Give your rewards to someone else. Yet I will read the writing to the king, and I will make known the interpretation. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people and nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew. Whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he set up. And whom he would, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind was hardened in pride, he was deposed of his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. And they fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that God appointed over the kingdom of men whomsoever he will. Verse 22, and thou, O son, O Belshazzar, has not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. You're responsible. Verse 23, instead you've lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drunk wine in them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and brass and iron and wood and stone, which can't see, which can't hear, that don't know anything, and the God in whose hand your breath is, and whose are all your ways you have not glorified. Isn't that a great statement? He said, you have taken these vessels that were dedicated to the living God, and you use them for your party with all your women and all your lords so that you could set yourself up as being a big deal, though you know that your own father was made crazy by the very God for the purpose of teaching him that the God in heaven rules over the kingdom of men. And though you knew it, you nevertheless worshiped stones and rocks and gold and silver that doesn't see, that doesn't think, that doesn't know anything, and you've ignored the God of heaven in whose hand your next breath is. You get that? From Daniel's way of thinking, the next breath you take is a matter of grace and sovereignty. From Daniel's point of view, the very fact that you know your own name is a matter of grace and sovereignty. That you are alive today and have any sense of who God is a matter of grace and sovereignty as far as Daniel's concerned. And it doesn't matter if you're heathen, it doesn't matter if you're a Christian, it doesn't matter if you're the richest man or the most debased man on the planet, your next breath is in God's hand. Then, verse 24, then was the part of the hand sent from God, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Anybody want to interpret for us? Anybody got that one for us? Anyone want to work that out? Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Many, says Daniel, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Now, that's a very, very interesting phrase. You know why? Because all through the Bible, you find God talking about, like with the Egyptians. Part of the reason that he waited the 400 years and finally came in, took his people out, and then judged the Egyptians is that he said that their sin, their iniquity, had finally come to the full. There was a point that God was waiting for. And when that point was full, he acted. He reacted. In the chapter 11 of the book of Romans, it says that the time of the Gentiles, the time that we're living in right now, that this time of the Gentiles will reach a point where the full number, the pleru, we talked about the difference between the pleru and kleru this last week, full or empty, that the fullness of the Gentiles will come. And once God reaches the fullness, where he's brought in everybody he's going to bring in, it says that once that's done, he closes that time and goes back to dealing with Israel. And this is the same way God has always worked. Daniel said, you see that word mene? That means your kingdom's been numbered, the days are up, the time is over, and you're finished. Because God is working on a set plan. This is the interpretation of the thing mene. God has numbered your kingdom and he has finished it. By the way, it was said twice. Mene, mene. You've been numbered, finished. Tekel means you are weighed in the balances. God's going to weigh it out for you and found wanting. You've been weighed and God decided you lose. Peres, by the way, is an ancient Chaldean word for Persian. So he says, Peres, your kingdom is divided and it is given to the Medes and the Persians. Daniel knew exactly what was coming up. Now, that's why we wrote up here, the next kingdom to come behind this, after Babylon, was the Medo-Persian Empire coming. And look at this, while they were outside the wall, coming in under the river and coming in under the wall, Daniel is in there with all the captains and the princes and saying, the kingdom is taken from you right now. You've been weighed in the balances and found wanting, and it's going to be given to the Persians, who at that very moment were coming under the wall and opening the gate and the armies were flooding in. Isn't that something? Because God said, your time's up. Your number's up, you're done. Tonight we hand the kingdom over. By daybreak, he was dead and the kingdom of Babylon belonged to the Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, they clothed Daniel with scarlet, and they put a chain of gold around his neck, and they made a proclamation concerning him, that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being only 62 years old, because God broke the spirit of Babylon. Okay, now, turn to, now that we get the frame here, and now that, as promised, I told you that we were going to look at that writing on the wall, the handwriting on the wall. And from now on, by the way, next time you hear somebody talk about the handwriting on the wall, can you read the handwriting on the wall? Realize that that's a twist of the real phrase. It's not handwriting on the wall. It was a hand writing on the wall. Is the way that phrase is. Well, I'm a very picky old man. Look at Daniel 7. Turn over there. Now that you know that, when chapter 7 opens with, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, you now have some sense of who this is and when this particular prediction came about. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed, and he wrote the dream and he told the sum or the totality of these matters. Daniel spoke and he said, I saw in the vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon a great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, and they were diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and he had an eagle's wings. Are you familiar with a griffin? You know what a griffin is? A lion with wings? It's become the trademark of Merv Griffin Enterprises. Watch the end of Wheel of Fortune. You can find yourself a griffin. This is an ancient Babylonish god that they used to worship. And so that was the beast that Daniel saw in particular, a lion that had wings. I beheld until the wings thereof were plucked off it, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon its feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So we now know that it represents a man, a king. But the angel's going to interpret for us, fortunately, so it's easy. Then behold, there was another beast, a second that was like a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth between the teeth of it. And they said unto it, arise and devour much flesh. Don't forget that this is the first year of Belshazzar, who had a very short reign before the events that we just saw that happened when the hand came and wrote on the wall. And Nebuchadnezzar, I'm going to tell you, is the lion with wings who was the man that stood up. And then the bear coming behind it is the Medo-Persians, which is why, and the angel will tell us that in a moment, which is why the one side is lifted up higher, is that between the Medes and Persians, the Persians ruled over the Medes, but they co-ruled. So you had two kings, but Darius was superseded by Cyrus. So you have that one side lifted up over the other as the Persians ruled over the Medes. And it was told that it was to go and devour much flesh, which is an interesting thing for it to be ready to do at this point in Belshazzar's command as king, because that's exactly what it did and was doing at the time, sweeping westward from Persia into Babylon. Verse 6. After this I beheld, and lo, there was another beast like a leopard, which had upon its back four wings of a fowl. And the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. It's going to come and conquer. We'll interpret in a moment when the angel does. Verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, there was a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth, and it devoured, and it broke into pieces, and it stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Does that sound familiar? Now, because of that, because it's not described as a particular animal, it's not called a lion, it's not called a leopard, it's not called a bear. So the theological term that commentators use is the nondescript beast. It's a beast that wasn't described. All we know about it is that it has teeth of iron, and we know down here you've got your legs of iron, which becomes Rome, and that it stamps and it destroys, and then suddenly we make this leap to the fact that it has 10 horns. So if you start following the succession, you can see the kingdoms being delineated here, but we'll let the angel say it so that it's not Jim interpreting. But then, out of these 10 horns, verse 8, Daniel says, I considered the horns. He's now looking at these 10 horns. And behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns that were plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. Now, I've told you that when Antichrist comes into power, he's going to create a 10-nation confederacy. We saw it over here when Daniel talked about the 10 toes of iron and clay and how he makes a 7-year peace pact and how 3.5 years into the 7-year deal, Daniel's 70th week, that he's going to break that deal, go into perdition, set up an idol of himself in the temple, show himself that he is God. But the first thing that he's going to do in creating his 10-nation confederacy is that he's going to take 3 of those nations by force, the other 7 give him the power. We see this said over and over. Here Daniel says it one more time, that there were 10 horns, and 3 of those horns were plucked up by the roots, and the horn was given eyes like a man and a mouth speaking great things. And I beheld, verse 9, I beheld until the thrones were cast down. Cast is an odd interpretation. I don't know what your translations say, but we're set in place is a much better translation of what it means. I beheld until the thrones were set down, set in place. In the Ancient of Days, God only did sit down, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool, and his throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels were as burning fire. A fiery stream issued forth and came forth from before him. Thousands, thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. Now, one more time, you find that the judgment comes on the heels of the Antichrist kingdom and the 10-toed, 10-nation confederacy. It's consistent everywhere we look. First, Antichrist comes, he builds his 10-nation confederacy, then the judgment happens. Now, this exact language that the thrones were set, the Ancient of Days sat, and the judgment began, when you read chapter 4 of the book of Revelation, John begins by saying, I saw thrones set down, and judgment began. Same thing Daniel was seeing here, which is a reason that we know the balance of the book of Revelation is the balance of God's judgment that happens at the end of Daniel's 70th week. Same language. But we'll get to all that. I beheld, and the thrones were set down, and the Ancient of Days did sit. Verse 11. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which this little horn had spoken. And I beheld even until that beast, that was the little horn in his 10-nation confederacy, till the beast was slain, and his body was destroyed and given over to the burning fire. Verse 12, and as concerning the rest of the beasts, the lion and the bear and the leopard and the nondescript beast, they had their dominion taken away from them, and yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. God is a God of set times, that God let each of them be kings on earth for a set amount of time, and then he rooted them up. And I saw in the night visions, and beheld one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him, and there was given to him dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all the people and the nations and the languages should serve him, and his dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is that which shall not be destroyed. Does that language sound familiar to you now? Every time you see the Antichrist, every time you see the 10-nation confederacy, you see Christ coming back in glory. And every time he's given a kingdom, which is set up on earth, and all people and nations bow before him. Now this week on Sunday morning, we're going to get to the next part of Philippians 2 that says that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. It's the exact same theology that says that despite the fact that the evil world will continue to toast their gods of wood and iron and brass and will continue to worship these gods that are not gods, that don't know anything, that don't speak, that are incapable of doing anything for them. And the fact that the world will continue to go crazier and crazier, a time will come when Christian, non-Christian, in fact, Philippians is going to say that things above the earth, which means everything in heaven, things on the earth, which means everybody alive and ever lived, and things below the earth, which means every demon in hell, is going to bow the knee to Christ. Which is why I say all the time that we don't need to worry when, you know, like Falwell jumps up and makes his comments about Islam being, or saying Muhammad was a terrorist and now you've got riots in India as a result of that comment. The reason I said it was a foolish comment is because you don't have to defend God. God is going to defend God and Muhammad will bow the knee to Jesus. Just like every other person of every other religion that followed every other god will willingly or unwillingly bow the knee to Christ because his word says in Daniel, in Revelation, in Philippians, this is the consistent biblical language that says every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God. Things above the earth, things on the earth, things below the earth. There's nothing left out there. You're either above, below, or on. Those are your three options. Whichever group you're in, you're bowing the knee. And some are going to bow willingly. Some are going to bow right away. Some are going to say, you're the Lord. Others, that's why it says that he smashes them with a rod of iron. I think he's going to start by breaking kneecaps because a whole lot of people are going to fall down in front of him very fast. Yes, ma'am?
Isn't that the verse that Universalists use to say that everybody, everything will...
Right, sure. And the reason that it doesn't work as a universalist verse is that it says things below the earth will bow the knee. And they're saying bow the knee necessarily is equitable with salvation. But it's not. Any more than conquered people submitting to a conquering king necessarily means that they agree with him. As long as you brought that up. Funny part is, genuine Catholic theology, universalist Catholic theology, says that everybody, including Satan, will eventually be saved because God, being a holy, righteous God, could never live in a universe where anybody or anything was suffering. So that eventually, over time, God is going to save everyone and everything, including Satan himself, and that is the genuine universalist theology. However, those very same people don't even agree with their own pope, which is evidence that you can be under the dominion of someone and not necessarily agree with them, but they don't even see the dichotomy of their own theology. All right, so look at this. Verse 14, I'll read it again just because I like it so much. The Son of Man will be given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, all nations, all languages should serve him. By the way, I have told you many times that the kingdom Christ is going to set up is an earthly kingdom that he's going to set up on planet Earth. Here it says, all people, all nations. When we get to heaven, will there be nations? No, of course not. There's no national divisions in heaven. What about languages? Will there be division of languages? No, of course not. So once again, you see the physicality of the language. The language that Daniel uses, the words he chose to use, have a physical, earthly nature to them. The kingdom that Jesus is coming to set up is an earthly, physical kingdom. Despite the interpretations out there to the contrary. Yes, ma'am?
Just for the sake of argument, then...
I can't imagine.
Me, I know. I certainly do not disagree that it's an earthly kingdom. Mm-hmm. I was brought up believing that this was a kingdom that would be established in heaven, but that all peoples, nations, tribes, tongues would all worship and bend their knee here, even though we would consciously be aware that this kingdom was in heaven.
Okay. I mean, sure, there are people who say that, but the language of the Bible disputes it. Oh, well, once you're wandering down the path of religion, the word "that's bizarre" is almost redundant. Because people interpret wildly. But the language, again, whether you're talking about Jesus walking around on the planet saying, "Pray thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." This was the prayer he gave his apostles. I mean, why would he tell them to pray that if it was a heavenly kingdom that they were going to go possess? Who cares about the earth connection? Or in the end of the book of Ezekiel, you get five chapters, and really it's 10 chapters altogether by the time you add all the ordinances and the exercises and everything, about a temple in Jerusalem that has never been built. And in Ezekiel's order of things that happen, it happens after Christ has come and after the Jews have been restored, the final temple is built. Now, is there any point to him taking five chapters to describe the physicality, the dimensions, the furniture of this entire temple if it's not going to be on earth? Why would we need a temple in heaven? We don't need a temple in heaven. There's no point to that. Every one of my amillennial, heavily interpretive friends, when they start madly interpreting and spiritualizing things, I always take them to the end of the book of Ezekiel. And I say, until you can give me the spiritual interpretation of these five chapters, you're stuck. And of course, that's when they all, "Well, you know," and then the conversation's pretty much over. So the language is so physical and so earthly all the time. And in the book of Revelation and Daniel's predictions, it's always Jesus coming from heaven with his army to earth. If it's a heavenly kingdom, what's the point of him coming here? We go to him. So the language is consistently physical and earthly, is my point. All right, let's get to the interpretation. Verse 14, "And there was given to him dominion and glory and a kingdom." Yeah, and a kingdom. By the way, same Hebrew word. There were all these kingdoms. There was a Babylonish kingdom. There was a Medo-Persian kingdom on earth. There was a Greek kingdom on earth, the Roman kingdom. And then there's going to be these 10 kings who are going to rise up, and they're given a kingdom. And then Jesus comes and establishes a kingdom that will never be destroyed. Again, same word, same language all the way through. Earthly kingdom, earthly kingdom, earthly kingdom, earthly kingdom. To say that Jesus' kingdom for some reason suddenly is a heavenly kingdom, you would have to find what's called an exegetical imperative, which means something in the language that forces you to change the meaning of the word and say, okay, physical kingdom, physical kingdom, physical kingdom. Oh, heavenly kingdom! When in fact it just says kingdom every time. So again, unless you have something in the text itself that makes you change from physical, when you do it, it's just an invention. It's something you just randomly decided to do because it suits your theology. "And there was given to him dominion and glory." We're going to get past this verse eventually, but I like it too much. "And there was given to him dominion and glory and a kingdom. And all the people and the nations and the languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit and in the midst of my body, and the vision of my head troubled me. And I came near unto one of them that stood by, and I asked him the truth of all this. So he told me, and he made known to me the interpretation of these things." Well, good, that's helpful. Now we don't have to interpret. Well, this will help a lot. Verse 17, "These great beasts, which are four, are four kings that shall rise out of the earth." Now, there's been a bit of consternation there because since this is happening after Nebuchadnezzar is dead, to say four kings rising up out of the earth as if they're rising to establish their kingdom is a misreading of the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word actually means rising from their seat to leave the stage. And Nebuchadnezzar had done that. He had already risen from his seat of power and left the stage of history. That rise up isn't a rise up to establish a kingdom. It's a, here's the kingdom, it's now rising and leaving. Got the picture? These are four kingdoms that are going to rise up and leave. By the way, since we're here, And I have to make this leap because I told you a couple weeks ago that the demonic power that controlled Alexander the Great, that was not during the time of Rome, that was but was not during John's time but will be again. Remember all that? You gotta remember the stuff from a few weeks ago. I told you that that same demonic power was going to come back and inhabit the Antichrist here. Okay, notice what the angel just said. We have Babylon, which is going to be the lion. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kingdoms to deal with. And he just said that this vision is how many kings?
4 kings.
4 kings, right. And not just kingdoms, but kings in particular, which is why the lion stood up and was given a heart like a man, why the little horn was given eyes like a man. We're talking about particular kings. But we've got 5 kingdoms, we've got 4 kings to deal with here. So one of these is going to be left out, right? We know it's not this one because we know we got the 10-toed kingdom here that we're dealing with, the 10-horned kingdom, the little horn rises up. So we know it's not that one, and we know it's not this one. We're going to find that out. In a minute, we'll know which of these kings is left out. Oh, a little mystery, huh? Verse 17. These great beasts which are 4 kings that shall rise and leave the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. How definitive is that? I like that. They're going to take it forever and forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the 4th beast, which was diverse from all the others, and was exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, and he devoured and he broke into pieces and he stamped with the residue of his feet and of the 10 horns that were in his head. Now this is going to be easier for us now. Are you familiar with the word preterist? Do you know what preterism is?
Yeah.
Some of you know it. Well, that was a nice reaction, yes. Preterism is simply the interpretive scheme that says that everything that's predicted in the Bible prophetically has happened. As of 70 AD and the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, that's the end of all of Daniel's prophecies. If you're a full preterist, then you even go so far as to say there's no reason to take the Lord's Supper anymore because Jesus said that he wouldn't drink of the fruit of the vine until I drink it with you in the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven was established in 70 AD. God has dispersed Israel. He's never going to deal with them anymore. And so we are now living in this sort of period of the golden age of grace. We're in the millennium now, as it were, until Jesus comes back. But everything predictive, prophesied, finished as of 70 AD. Which makes me, if this is the golden age, if we're living in the millennium right now, makes me want to, like, sing, "Is that all there is?" I mean, you know, this is, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty rough millennium if this is the big golden age everybody's been waiting for. But in any case, one of the things that they do interpretively is that they say that this nondescript beast, because it's of iron, the iron teeth, they say, well, then it's Rome. And they say that the 10 horns are the first 10 of the Roman Caesars. And that's the end of the 10-toed kingdom. And I always want to say to them, but then it says Jesus comes back and sets up his kingdom. Now you've got your, well, then we necessarily have to interpret that spiritually and say Jesus did come back in 70 AD in judgment, that he destroyed Jerusalem, that he scattered the Jews once and for all, and he set up his kingdom that shall never be destroyed, which is a heavenly kingdom. Get it? That's kind of the leap that they take. Unfortunately, what this really says here, if you look at the language, is that he leaps right over Rome. And he says he wanted to know about the 4th beast. We now know that the 4th beast, the nondescript beast, whose teeth were of iron, also had nails of brass. He devoured, he broke into pieces, he stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head. So we're not talking about Rome here. We're talking about the final kingdom, the 10-toed kingdom, the nondescript beast. And of the other which came up, the other horn, before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. Verse 21, I beheld, and that same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Gotta show you this. This is so cool. This is so interesting. When Daniel was writing all this, who did it concern? Daniel's people, Daniel's city, right? Isn't that what we began with way back when? This all has to do with Daniel's city and Daniel's people. So when he says saints here, who's he referring to? He's dealing with Israel, Daniel's people, Daniel's city. The word saints, hagios in the Greek, kadesh in the Hebrew, means exactly what I said earlier, set aside for God's own particular use. When he chose Israel, he set them aside for his particular use, made them holy, which means separated, and then called them saints. So when you get to the book of Revelation, again, if you think in 20th century Christian Gentile terms, you can't understand the book of Revelation. Because in the book of Revelation, it says that there are saints during the time of the Antichrist, and that he makes war with the saints, and he overcomes the saints. So if you go leaping in there with a 20th century Gentile Christian notion, you say, well, it says saints right here. There it is. I've had so many people bring that up to me and say, well, it says right here that the Antichrist makes war with the saints and he overcomes them. The saints are the church. Saints, he overcomes the saints.
The left behind theology.
That's the left behind theology. Absolutely. That any place you see the word elect or saints, that necessarily means the church. Except Isaiah said, Israel mine elect, Jacob whom I have chosen. So
Daniel had no idea about that.
Daniel had no idea of the church. There is no church. So again, saints, don't get upset when you're reading the book of Revelation and you see saints. All that means is people that God chose and set aside for his particular use, who in the book of Revelation are Israel, which I will show you time and time again. And here it is that he makes war with the saints and prevailed against them. Verse 22, for how long? Until the Ancient of Days came and the judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Then he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all the other kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth. It shall tread it down. It shall break it into pieces. The 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 of those kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and he shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change the times and the laws, the seasons and the customs. And they shall be given, the saints, into his hand until a time and a times and a dividing of time. How many is that? Time would be 1, times 2, so that makes 3. And what's a half? Half a time. You got 3.5 right there. Is that number sounding familiar to you yet? They will be delivered into his hands for 3.5 years. And he shall speak great words against the Most High and wear out the saints of the Most High. Verse 26, but the judgment shall be set, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. And hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. So, now we know this. We know that Babylon is represented as a lion with wings. We know that Medo-Persia is represented as a bear. We know that Greece as a leopard with 4 wings. And then we know that the 10-nation confederacy is this nondescript beast, which I think is interesting that when you get into John talking about the Antichrist, that he calls him the beast. That's where John gets that language. He gets it directly from Daniel, that he is the nondescript beast. Okay, one last thing. Let's do this. Turn over to Revelation now. If I wait and show you this next week, you won't see the connection. Revelation 13, and then we're done. You keeping up okay? Is this too much for one night? We all right? All right. Chapter 13, starting at verse 1. We're just going to look at the first 10 verses. Now, I've always told you that you can't just go plunging into the book of Revelation. If you just go diving in without all your background, you come up with all these symbols and you don't know what the symbols mean. But if you take a look at them in their historic biblical context, it's not hard to interpret them at all. Chapter 13, verse 1 says, I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns there were 10 crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy. We saw a similar vision of that a few weeks ago, right? This dragon beast that comes up out of the sea, this has seven heads, which are kingdoms, we found out, 10 horns, which we just talked about, the 10 horns, right? And 10 crowns, which are the kings over those horns. And upon his head was the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw looked like this. It was like a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth was as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon, who was already identified as Satan, gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Now, what does that tell us? That tells us that this guy is going to rise up the feet of a bear, that the place that he's going to stand, the place that he's going to work from, is the old Medo-Persian Empire, which I keep telling you, the Antichrist is coming out of the Middle East. Go to the back of your Bible or get online and find a map of the Medo-Persian Empire. That's where we're watching. This guy is not coming out of France.
It's not a blonde Russian.
It's not a blonde Russian, despite the movies. It's not a Texas oil man. He's not going to be Japanese. He's not going to be African. He's going to come out of the area of Medo-Persia. This is very interesting. He's going to speak as a lion. He's going to speak that old Babylonish talk that is so prevalent in religion today. That Babylonish talk that people really do like. That Babylonish, we agree with all the gods. That inculcation of all the gods that Babylon was so popular and so well liked for. And the way that you can have any god you want. It doesn't matter what god you worship. Just bring them all and it's fine. Typical Babylon. And he's going to speak great flowing words. He's going to speak directly from Babylon. And Satan, it says, the devil is going to give him his power and authority. And he's going to speak for the devil. But then look at the one last part here that I find really interesting. It says that when I saw him, he was like a leopard. What did I tell you? That's the beast that's coming back. This is the beast that's coming back, the leopard beast. And he's coming up out of the area of Medo-Persia, and he's going to speak from Babylon. But he's going to be ruled by the devil. This is going to be a tough guy. Now, the good news is we're not here, but I'll prove that to you. Did you hear? Was anybody here Sunday? But there was actually somebody who contested with me and said, I don't believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. I said, stick around. I had a preacher say to me many years ago, he said, you can't find a rapture in the Bible. And I said, me? I can't find a rapture in the Bible? I don't get to the seventh from Adam. I don't get to Enoch before he flies off the planet. You look at the book of Hebrews, it says that he walked and talked with God. It was not because God took him. I don't get seven generations in. Seven, very interesting number, by the way. Seventh from Adam, by the way, thought I'd point out. He's raptured right off the planet and then picked up in the book of Hebrews and established as being that. I don't get to Elijah and Elisha before the chariot comes down, picks up Elijah, and he goes off the planet alive. If that ain't a rapture, what is? Philip, it says, baptized the Ethiopian eunuch, and when they came up out of the water, Philip disappeared and was found preaching on the other side of the country at the very same moment. If that ain't a rapture. By the way, the word that is used there, catching away, harpazo, the Greek word harpazo that says that Philip was caught away from there, snatched away by a force larger than himself, and then deposited over here to preach, is the exact same word, harpazo, used for the rapture. People say, well, why did God do that? I say, well, just prove he could. So that when he would use the word harpazo later to say he's going to come and harpazo the church and snatch them away and take them off, people are like, well, you can't find a rapture in the Bible. No, I can't find the word, no. But the concepts, they're all over the place. Can't find Trinity in the Bible, but the concepts, they're all over the place. That's why it's true. So anyway, me, I'd be the wrong guy to fight with over a rapture. I can find a rapture everywhere. But of course, as soon as I said, well, I don't get seven generations from Adam before you find the first guy flying off the planet. Well, that's not what I'm talking about, you know. I said, no, you said I couldn't find a rapture in the Bible. That wasn't hard. I don't get out of Genesis. I don't get 10 chapters into Genesis before I got people flying off the planet. Anyway. These kids and their raptures. What are you? Hi. So anyway, I lost control of the room. How did that happen? And the beast which you saw was like unto a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. That's where he's planted. His mouth spoke as a lion out of Babylon. The dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority, and I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered at him. Now, what do those heads represent?
Kingdoms.
We saw that. Seven kingdoms. So does this mean, remember when Reagan got shot, and all the prophecy preachers jumped up and said, if he comes back alive, he's it. No, this is not a man who gets shot and then is okay again. You have to think about what we read last week. The beast that was before John's time was not during the Roman Empire and will rise again to go into perdition. The head that was wounded and then healed is one of the seven kingdoms. I'm telling you, one of these five is coming back, and we already know that he comes back out of Greece.
Also, we're not going to see somebody get up after being shot.
In the head? No, they get a wound in the head.
That certainly is the left behind theology. That's all these Hagee books, these top selling John Hagee books. That's what he says. Watch for a man to get shot and then rise up again. He'll be the Antichrist. What? Yeah, Kennedy would have. Oh, absolutely. When he got shot in the head, don't you? Well, I'm old enough to remember. I'm older than all of you put together. But when Kennedy got shot, yes, everybody was waiting to see if he was going to recover because he got shot in the head. I mean, this was it. This is what we're waiting for. No. It says here, seven heads, which are seven kingdoms, one of those heads is wounded as unto death because he was not during John's time, but would rise again and go into perdition. His deadly wound was healed and all the world wondered after the beast. Got it? They worship the dragon that gave power to the beast, and they worship the beast, and they say, who is like the beast, and who is able to make war with the beast? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. Does that sound familiar? We just read all that in Daniel. Same language. There was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given to him to continue how long? 42 months, 3.5 years. What a surprise, there's that number again. And he opened his mouth to blaspheme against God, to blaspheme his name and his temple and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given to him to make war with the saints. The church. Yeah, he made war with the church. I said, no. Made war with the saints, the Hagias, the set aside. He's making war with Israel here. And to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations, and all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Didn't we just see that in another passage of Revelation 2 weeks ago? That everybody left on the earth is on the earth because their names are not written in the Lamb's book of life since before the foundation of the world. So where are the people whose names were written in the Lamb's book of life since before the foundation of the world? Well, they're not on earth. They're doing this. Exactly. Looking down. Yes, absolutely.
But it also disproves all that everybody will be saved.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
yes.
If
you want to see that everybody won't be saved, at the end of the book of Revelation, when Jesus comes back, it says that the people on earth run to the rocks and the caves and the dens of the earth, crying for the rocks to fall on them to hide them from the wrath of the Lamb. And as I've often said, if all people need to be saved is adequate inducement, if all you need to do to get somebody to make Jesus their Lord and Savior is to give them a convincing enough argument, and then they will, of their own free will and intelligence, decide to make him Lord and Savior, this would be the time. The stars are darkened. The sun won't show its light. The moon has become like sackcloth and ashes. There's no light in heaven and no light on the earth when suddenly the sign of the Son of Man appears in heaven as lightning is from the east to the west and all the world beholds it at once. That's adequate inducement. So what do? Do they all run out and say, I make you Lord and Savior, therefore you must save me? No, they run to the caves and the dens of the earth and they hide from him because they are evil, because they are depraved, because they, even with adequate inducement and seeing him coming, don't have the ability to make him Lord and Savior, nor do they have the ability to believe and have faith. Instead, they run and say, kill us, he's back. You know, I'm sorry, that popular theology just doesn't wash. It's not in the Bible anywhere. All them that dwell upon the earth will worship him, the devil, whose names were not written in the Lamb's book of life from the foundation of the world. If any man has an ear, let him hear. He that leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. And here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb. But he spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him. And he causes all the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. We'll get to that. That is not the Antichrist, that's the false prophet. You're going to see that the false prophet is the one who drives everybody to worship him, because there's a world religion coming that's going to say, it's okay to worship him. We worship everything. We worship all the gods, and he's the god of earth right now. Worship him the same way that we worship all our heroes. He's going to become the hero of earth. Now, it says that he's going to become hero of the earth through craft and through peace. And he's going to hoodwink and befuddle people through peace. And at a time when they are saying, peace, peace, then sudden destruction comes. And there will be no peace until the Prince of Peace comes back and establishes his kingdom, and all the knees bow and all the tongues confess that he is Lord. Until then, there's going to be plenty of people trying to make peace over there in the Middle East, but it's not going to work. It's going to get worse and worse and worse until people like George Bush, who want to know better, will inexplicably decide we need to go over and bomb Babylon. We need to go to Iraq and bomb Babylon. And that will, of course, make them attack Israel. Right. And Israel is prepared to attack back.
Like it did before.
And it's going to take somebody to rise up out of the Middle East and create a 10-nation confederacy over there and say, okay, peace, and we're going to let Israel rebuild its temple, and we're not going to push you into the sea, and peace is going to come to the earth right on the brink of World War III. And everybody's going to wonder at the beast and say, who is like the beast and who can make war with him? He's going to bring peace. And through that peace, he's going to destroy wonderfully, it says. Anytime you see destroy wonderfully stuck together. That's all coming, kids. I mean, that's what the Bible says is going to happen. And you can sit here. It's an interesting time to be alive, because we're kind of watching all this stuff develop very quickly in the Middle East. 20 years ago, if you had said that the fulcrum of world political, geopolitical power and the potential destruction of the earth was going to circle around Jerusalem, people go, well, you're nuts. No, it's going to be Russia. It's going to be communist China. It's going to be one of those places where there's a billion people. No, the Bible always said it was going to be Jerusalem.
That's
time's ticking down. Absolutely.
The main focus of everything.
Yeah. Because God said, this is the place where I will choose to place my name. And as soon as God placed his name there, everything else in the world circles around it. I also think it's interesting, I'll dig it out for you. There's a verse where in this final conflagration, one of the things that the angel cries as they're destroying the earth is, hurt not the oil. But anyway.
I drove an SUV.
Yeah, I do drive an SUV. Well, the angel drives an SUV, so hurt not the oil. I drive a little Honda SUV, so I feel good about it. Okay, any other questions for the... Yes, ma'am.
I'm either confused or have not made the leap yet, or we have not got to it yet. What is the purpose of this earthly kingdom for those of us sitting in heaven?
We're not. When he comes back at the end of the 7.5 years, we come back with him. And during the millennium, it says we will rule and reign with Christ. He told his apostles, particularly, you will be given 12 thrones and you will rule over the 12 tribes of Israel. But there is righteousness on the earth for a couple of reasons. Number one, Christ is the king ruling on earth, which is the completion of his messiahship. All of the Old Testament prophets, when they predicted the Messiah to come, they said that he would rule on earth. When he came here, he didn't do that. He came, he served, and he died. He's coming back to rule on earth to complete all of those predictions. The other reason there will be peace on earth is that for those 1,000 years, Satan is bound, cast into the bottomless pit, and it says that he will not deceive the nation for those 1,000 years. Now, once the 1,000 years are up at the end of the book of Revelation, it says that Satan is then unloosed. He immediately goes into perdition. It says that he continues for a very short space, and then God creates the new heavens and the new earth, and then the final judgment. The sea gives up the dead, hell gives up the dead, everybody gives up, and there's the judgment of all the unsaved. So there's a whole lot yet to do, but there's a 1,000-year millennium where Jesus will rule and reign on earth to complete his messiahship, and he will rule in righteousness and in justice. But I got an email the other day from somebody who said, will there be sin during the millennium? And I said, yes, absolutely. Zechariah says that every year all the Gentiles are going to have to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, and then those that don't or who resist it, it says that Jesus puts curses on them. So even during the millennium, there will be humans, and as long as there's humans, there's sinful humans. That won't be you and me. We'll be walking around in the bodies that Jesus has, that are the sinless, resurrected, perfect, eternal bodies. They're as comfortable in heaven as they are on earth. But there will still be humans because Jesus will rule over humans. And they will all bow the knee to him one way or the other.
Will they be saved, dying?
Living and dying, absolutely. See, people think that's so bizarre, but it's not bizarre in the least. God has done this several times now on planet Earth where he kind of wiped out everybody and started again.
Noah.
He did it with Noah. I'll take you eight and we'll just start again. And that's exactly what he's going to do. He's going to come down in judgment, which is why he said, you know, I'll never destroy the earth again with water. I'll put the rainbow up here and I'll never destroy the earth with water. And then Peter comes and says, that's right. He's going to do it with fire. So he's going to come and he's... you know, that's right. So he's going to come back and destroy the earth again and start over again. And when he starts over again, it'll be with a small group of people. But this time, finally, it's going to do it the way he wants it done because he's going to be sitting on earth ruling and reigning. And when it says we rule and reign with him, that kind of language, our natural fleshly ego goes, yeah, rule! You know, I rule! But yeah, exactly. But in fact, exactly. The difference will be is that we will be in a glorified body without the sinful stuff that goes on in our heads and minds so that we will perfectly serve and we will be the saints of the Lord, the hagios, the set aside that he has always intended us to be, that as long as we're in this flesh, won't ever be able to perfect. So he will have his kingdom of righteousness on earth before it's all said and done. When you look at whether it's Jude or whether it's the Old Testament Joel or whether it's the apocryphal book of Enoch, or whether it's the end of the book of Revelation, when Jesus comes back, it says that he comes back with the thousands of his saints. And they all say the exact same thing, which is that we all come back with him, this massive army. And then he sets up his kingdom and we rule and reign with him. Now that language is so specific and repetitive that when you ask, well, what's it going to look like? Or what? How does it delineate? Or what's the architecture? I don't know.
So it's not,
but I know we're coming back.
On earth at this
no, but Christ is reigning.
So
it
no,
is,
because
Satan is bound.
Because
so
Peter says in the end of Book of Revelation says that when that 1,000 years is up, he then makes the new heavens and the new earth.
Mm-hmm.
And that heavens is not the heavens up there. It's the atmosphere and the new earth. And he starts completely over, and that's what we would call paradise, because there is no more Satan, there is no more evil, there are no more bad people. I got to let folks go. If you guys are waiting on your kids and you got
to
go, go. I kept you too long.
Oh,
but oh, well, then quit asking questions.
You have to go.
Okay.
So Satan's bound.
Yeah, for the 1,000 years.
With their sinful nature. Excuse me.
No. Not we, whoever hears. Yes.
And it's not just Jews.
No, it's Gentiles as well.
And why would they have made it through?
Because God brought them through.
Okay.
Yeah. Why did Noah make it through the flood?
Think about babies
being born
and going.
Yes. Sure.
Still goes all, they'll be married.
Exactly right.
Even in